So, yeah, I came prepared to talk a little bit about myself, but really the way I talk about myself is by talking about what I do. So, my name's Connor Boyack. I'm the president of an organization called Libertas Institute here in Utah. And it was founded about a year ago. And we are dedicated to advancing the cause of liberty here in Utah. So we do that through a number of facets, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a bit. But before talking more about why I do what I do and why that's important, I wanted to talk a little bit about my political genesis, how I got to this point. So once I had my political awakening, I realized that the Fox News Republican upbringing that I had was not sufficient. And I actually joined the Constitution Party. And then this guy Ron Paul ran for Congress, and the talk back then was everyone join the Republican Party and become a delegate so we can get him elected. So I did that. Still very early in my political development, I didn't know a lot of what was going on, but I did that. And I got stuck. So I ended up joining Mike Lee's campaign when he ran for Congress, and had the opportunity to serve as a director on his campaign. After Mike's campaign, I joined an organization called the 10th Amendment Center. Maybe some of you have heard of that. They're a national group. And I was the Utah director, the chapter director for the 10th Amendment Center. What the 10th Amendment Center is focused on is helping legislatures throughout the state uphold the Constitution. So rather than fighting Congress, because that's rarely, if ever, successful, the 10th Amendment Center focuses on things like nullification and interposition and trying to get the legislatures to uphold the Constitution as they historically did and as they should today. We had some great opportunities. In fact, this was during 2010 when there were a lot of good nullification bills here in the state. We had a lot of good success at the legislature. So I thought, this is going great. I'm having a great time. We're doing some good stuff. But I quickly realized that I wouldn't last there very long. The problem that I found was that I would link arms with all these legislators, and we'd shake our fists at the federal government, and we'd get bills passed that said, you know, we need to oppose this, or we need to uphold that. And that was all good. But then these same legislators would turn around and legislate at the state level the same tyranny that they were opposing at the federal level, without any recognition of that inconsistency or hypocrisy. Now, the Constitution does make clear that the federal government only has certain powers, but I think it's incorrect and very flawed thinking to think that simply because the federal government is prohibited that therefore the state should, or even that the state does have the authority to do X, Y, or Z. So I got really fed up and left the 10th Amendment Center, not because there's anything wrong with the 10th Amendment Center at all. It's a fantastic organization that I commend to you. But I realized that my efforts needed to be spent in a different way. For those who share my faith, the Mormon faith, a scripture came to mind as I was looking into this about cleansing the inner vessel. And I realized that if we're going to uphold the Constitution, it needs to start here at home. It's pointless to support a tyrannical state in Utah, and we do, in fact, have a soft tyrannical state in Utah, and try and get the federal government to adhere to the Constitution and to support liberty when we, many of us, support quite the opposite here at home. So I founded the Libertas Institute. It's focused primarily on Utah, government within Utah. Sir?
Spell that for us, and I'll write it on the board.
Sure. So Libertas is liberty, but instead of a Y, it's got an A-S. So Libertas. It's the Roman goddess of liberty. So the Statue of Liberty, her name is...
Instead of a Y, it's got an
A-S. So E-R, instead of that A.
E-R.
E-R-T-A-S. Libertas Institute. So it's the Statue of Liberty. Her name is Libertas. So, and I'll talk a little bit more about kind of what we're involved in as I go forward, but as I said, we advance the cause of liberty in Utah. And as I found it's helpful, even though we may think that we all understand it, I like to talk about definitions before I go any deeper. So when I say advance the cause of liberty, well, what's liberty? Let me at least convey to you what definition I operate with. To do that, I want to read two quotes. Many of these may be familiar, one of which comes from a gentleman who I very much admire, Frederick Bastiat. And he says this, "What is this liberty whose very name makes the heart beat faster and shakes the world? Is it not the union of all liberties, liberty of conscience, of education, of association, of the press, of travel, of labor, of trade? In short, is not liberty the freedom of every person to make full use of his faculties, so long as he does not harm other persons while doing so? Is not liberty the destruction of all despotism, including, of course, legal despotism? Finally, is not liberty the restricting of the law only to its rational sphere of organizing the right of the individual to lawful self-defense and of punishing injustice? Next quote, second definition of liberty, comes from Thomas Jefferson. He says that of liberty, I would say that in the whole plenitude of its extent, it is unobstructed action according to our will. But rightful liberty, he says, is unobstructed action according to our will within limits drawn around us by the equal rights of others. So in effect, liberty is the freedom, the ability to do whatever we please, provided that we are not violating another individual's rights. It's a very comprehensive definition. So we fight for liberty. We fight the state so that it doesn't violate liberty. We try and uphold the proper role of government. What is that proper role? This is from a gentleman who is likely familiar to all of you, Ezra Taft Benson. I like his definition, and there are many others that go with this, but he says it well. He says that this the proper function of government is limited only to those spheres of activity within which the individual citizen has the right to act. By deriving its just powers from the governed, government becomes primarily a mechanism for defense against bodily harm, theft, and involuntary servitude. It cannot claim the power to redistribute the wealth or force reluctant citizens to perform acts of charity against their will. Government is created by man. No man possesses such power to delegate. The creature cannot exceed the creator. So what does that mean? The proper role of government is extremely limited, only to the powers that you and I have as individuals, and that we can therefore delegate and choose to delegate to the government. This is far-reaching. I could list off so many examples, just a couple. You know, if this is a hot topic around the states, with a couple states legalizing marijuana, right? Many of us may choose not to consume it, may object to those who do, but do you or I as individuals have the right to force our neighbors not to do so? Do I have the right to use coercion against my neighbor should he choose to ingest it? If I don't, according to the definition as I understand it from Ezra Taft Benson and many other founding fathers, I can't delegate that authority to the government to wield on my behalf if I don't have it. So the cause of liberty is far-reaching. I think it's eternal. I think it's pervasive. But we're losing. Why? Hundreds of thousands of innocent people have died in the past decade alone as a result of the wars in the Middle East. They've lost their liberty. They've lost their life. A domestic surveillance and police state has been erected in the past decade since 9/11 here in America. We're losing our liberties. Corporations are being subsidized by taxpayer dollars, and then we're also being forced to fund their losses. We're losing our liberty. Wealth redistribution continues at an alarming rate, with a record number of people dependent upon food stamps, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and dozens of other programs. We're losing our liberty. Peaceful people are imprisoned for ingesting and exchanging naturally occurring substances such as marijuana or even raw milk, as absurd as that is. Americans are taxed on their income, their purchases, their property, and dozens of other life events and circumstances. You're familiar with the things on this list. The list is very long. We're losing the fight for liberty. Why? Some blame voter apathy. If we just got more people to the ballots, things would improve. People need to wake up. People need to participate. Others blame the media, say that they're just a propaganda arm for the state. And if the message of liberty could be on Fox News or CNN or wherever, people would be more educated. Some think that people just don't understand what liberty is, and that if we had this definition, if the Glenn Becks maybe of the world could better help people understand freedom, then people would protect it rather than violating it. I think all of these are true to some extent, but there's something more fundamental, and that's what I want to talk about tonight. That the cause of liberty will only be successful by restoring personal responsibility. So back to definitions real quick. What do I mean by responsibility? So responsibility means to have you have a duty to do something, right? It implies an obligation. It means that we'll be held accountable for something. Now, of course, being held accountable means that there's somebody to whom we're doing the accounting. If we have a duty, that means there's someone who can make sure that we're fulfilling that duty. So who are we responsible to? ourselves, our family members, our community, neighbors, God, most importantly. So remember that liberty means doing whatever we wish to, provided we don't violate anyone else's rights. In other words, a violation of liberty would mean prohibiting people from doing certain things that they should be allowed to, or forcing them to do certain things that they may not want to. But ultimately, the state violates liberty in this way because we as individuals aren't doing the things that we should. And that's where responsibility comes into play. I want to read two quotes that emphasize my point. One is from Alexis de Tocqueville in his very famous book, Democracy in America, that you've probably all heard of. He's a French political thinker. He says this, "Above this race of men stands an immense and tutelary power which takes upon itself alone to secure their gratifications and to watch over their fate. That power is absolute, minute, regular, provident, and mild. It would be like the authority of a parent if, like that authority, its object was to prepare men for manhood. But it seeks, on the contrary, to keep them in perpetual childhood. For their happiness, such a government willingly labors, but it chooses to be the sole agent and the only arbiter of that happiness. It provides for their security, foresees and supplies their necessities, facilitates their pleasures, manages their principal concerns, directs their industry, regulates the descent of property, and subdivides their inheritances. What remains but to spare them all the care of thinking and all the trouble of living?" And, sorry, he continues. I forgot this last little part. He continues, Thus it every day renders the exercise of the free agency of man less useful and less frequent. It circumscribes the will within a narrower range and gradually robs a man of all the uses of himself. Final quote to define this connection that I'm talking about between responsibility and liberty comes from an English writer by the name of Charles Caleb Colton. He says, "Liberty will not descend to a people. A people must raise themselves to liberty. It is a blessing that must be earned before it can be enjoyed." So I contend that liberty cannot exist without personal responsibility because they're effectively one and the same. They're two sides of the same coin, if you want to describe it that way. The coin would not exist without its two sides, responsibility being one of them. You're probably familiar with Viktor Frankl. He wrote Man's Search for Meaning. He was a Holocaust survivor, very influential. That book is immensely popular. And in that book, he says this, "Freedom is only part of the story and half of the truth. Freedom is but the negative aspect of the whole phenomenon, whose positive aspect is responsibleness. In fact, freedom is in danger of degenerating into mere arbitrariness unless it is lived in terms of responsibleness." So there's a story that I like to tell from America's founding that demonstrates what I'm talking about. And this comes from Tom Paine and John Adams. Now, I don't know how many of you are familiar with the rocky relationship that they had, albeit from a distance. They weren't close acquaintances by any means, but they knew who one another were. Tom Paine, of course, was the master essayist, the propagandist, right? He wrote Common Sense, which many people don't know was written anonymously at first because Tom Paine thought, rightly so, that it was treasonous, and so he wrote it anonymously. John Adams was thought by some to have been the author of that document. And at first, John Adams was flattered, right? Because John Adams had a little bit of an ego. And he was flattered by that. But the more he read it, the more he pondered it, the less he liked what was in Common Sense. In fact, when it was later discovered that Tom Paine was the author of that pamphlet, that's when kind of this rocky relationship began. In fact, John Adams wrote to his wife, Abigail, that Thomas Paine was, quote, "a better hand in pulling down than building." What does he mean by that? What he meant was that Tom Paine's essay, if you've read Common Sense, it very much excoriates the king. It's an essay full of the sins of the king, saying what the king had done to violate the freedoms of the Americans. He was pulling down. He was trying to pull down the monarchy, trying to dismantle the government, show people that we need to get rid of it. Well, along with Common Sense and his pulling down, Tom Paine had a proposal. And he said, well, here's this bad government, so here's what good government, in my idea, would be. Well, John Adams took issue with that, and he said, that's a horrible idea. For example, Tom Paine proposed a unicameral legislature rather than a House and a Senate. It would just be one chamber in Congress. And John Adams hated that idea. He thought there weren't necessary checks and balances. So John Adams was very critical of Tom Paine. For example, David McCullough, if you read some of his, he's a biographer. He did a biography on John Adams, and he says this. It was Tom Paine's feeble understanding of constitutional government, his outline of a unicameral legislature to be established once independence was achieved, that disturbed Adams most. In response, he began setting down his own thoughts on government, resolved, as he later wrote, to do all in my power to counteract the effect on the popular mind of so foolish a plan. A decade later, Adams held to his criticism of Tom Paine and his efforts when he wrote in a letter this: "It is much easier to pull down a government in such a conjuncture of affairs as we have seen than to build up at such season as present." A few years after that, French Revolution happened, right? A lot of tearing down of the existing monarchy. This is what John Adams says: "Everything will be pulled down, so much seems certain, but what will be built up? Are there any principles of political architecture? Will the struggle in Europe be anything other than a change in impostors?" So John Adams was extremely critical of Paine because he thought that Paine was, yes, good at tearing down, but he was not effective at building up. And what John Adams was looking for, what he attempted to provide himself, was a structure upon which new government could be built, good government could be built. So where are we at today, right? We have rampant corruption, sky-high spending, pervasive erosion of the principles necessary for good government. It's tempting, it's extremely easy to tear down, right? It's easy to watch the news or to write an email or read a letter to the editor and get upset and to find out where the problems are because they're so rampant, they're so abundant. I'm sure we are all masters at tearing down. We can have a demolition license and claim that we're good at destroying things because we are. But for all the time and energy that we spend tearing down politicians and ripping on laws, how many of us well-intentioned individuals lack a principled philosophical foundation to build a solid structure upon? How many of us Americans collectively tear down without being ready to rebuild? How many grasp in the dark for liberty without understanding how it applies to government and to the individuals who comprise that government without being prepared to live it themselves? We claim to want liberty, too many of us, but we do not want the corresponding responsibility. So John Adams talked about this change of imposters in the France government, and we've seen that in our own day. People fight for liberty and they think that candidate X will do it, and then candidate X gets into office and then maintains the status quo, if not increases the violation of liberty. Walter Williams, he's a conservative columnist, he says this, that our increased reliance on laws to regulate behavior is a measure of how uncivilized we've become. So if we want to dismantle this police state, the nanny state, welfare state, restore our lost liberties, my contention is that we once again need to become civilized and responsible. We must relearn and assume the responsibilities that the government has taken over for us and on our behalf. But building up good government, as John Adams advocated, requires that we first build up ourselves. 48.5%, in fact, I think it's increased a little bit since I last got this statistic for one of my books. 48.5%, last I saw, of Americans received some form of financial assistance from the federal government. Nearly half of Americans. Individuals today grovel at the feet of the state, begging to be cared for from cradle to grave. Even those who don't receive direct financial assistance, those who aren't part of this 48.5%, often support government-run education, the war on terror, the voluminous regulations imposed by the FDA, EPA, USDA, the use of taxation to finance social services at home and abroad, a host of other government interventions that encroach upon individual liberties. So 48.5% is a convenient metric that we can point to, but I think the problem is much more pervasive. And I think many more Americans don't understand that they need to be living responsibly. So there's a fascinating book that compiles all of the correspondence between John Adams and his wife Abigail, because they wrote extensively back and forth. And there was a letter that Abigail wrote back to her husband, kind of continuing on the same issue. And she says that we have too many high-sounding words and too few actions that correspond with them. Think about that. What does she mean? I think she means that there are too many hypocrites. And I don't think things have changed today, right? It's very easy, because I'm very involved politically, and I meet with legislators all the time, and it's very easy to get a legislator to tell you that they love liberty, and they support the Constitution, and they love the free market and want to protect the free market. And it's extremely easy, if that individual has a voting record, if they've been in office for any period of time, to go and find votes that contradict what they're saying, right? Here's Abigail Adams saying, we have too many high-sounding words and too few actions that correspond with them. I think she's advocating for consistency between the principles that we espouse and our actions. And I've said, I do a weekly radio show, and almost every week, I swear, I say that our biggest problem is inconsistency. Because you and I, we agree, support the Constitution, support freedom. Republicans agree, you know, Democrats agree. The head of the Utah Democratic Party, Jim DeBacchus, who's also a state senator, says he supports the Second Amendment. And then if you let him keep talking for any period of time, he goes on to then support policies that violate the Second Amendment. But it's very easy to find agreement on the principle and the theory. But then when you get into the specific policy, to find violations. So if Abigail's saying that we need actions that correspond with the high-sounding words, if we need responsibility to defend liberty, then what are the actions that we need to support responsibility, to practice responsibility? So I've written two books, as was mentioned. I'm an author. So the first one is Latter-day Liberty. And the second one, my most recent one, out a few months ago, is Latter-day Responsibility. Purpose of the two books, and I'll sell them afterwards if you're interested, is that they are two sides of the same coin. You can't have liberty without responsibility. And in this last book, where I focus on responsibility, what I did is I broke down chapter by chapter various responsibilities I think that we need to fulfill if we want to defend liberty. And that it's really fruitless to talk about supporting liberty if we're not implementing and living and practicing these responsibilities. So I want to go over briefly just a few of those responsibilities, because I think they dovetail then with understanding how we can support liberty. It's very easy in meetings like this and elsewhere to have these high-sounding words, as mm-hmm. Abigail Adams said. I'm guilty of that myself. I like high-sounding words. But what I want to touch on now is some of the actions that correspond with those that I think are important. And maybe you're doing perfect at this. I'm not. But collectively as Americans, we're horribly failing. And if you're doing great, then I buy a book for a friend, maybe, right? Because there's plenty of other people that need this message, I think. So the first one I want to talk about is self-defense. There's an interesting book called, and I wasn't going to talk about this, but it just came to mind, Dial 911 and Die. Kind of a bold title. It's a fascinating book. It goes through state by state and examines instances in which people have sought out police protection and either did not obtain that protection and died or were harmed, or the police officers who arrived actually ended up hurting or killing the people who requested the help. What's interesting about the book is they document a number of court cases. In fact, this has gone all the way up to the Supreme Court, where the justices have said that there is no duty upon police officers to protect an individual citizen. Police officers are not legally bound to protect anyone. There's this legal notion of collective security, collective justice, and that police officers are to preserve the peace and to protect people generally, but not specifically, which has all sorts of legal implications and quandaries as well. So the responsibility of self-defense, many people think it's been delegated to the police or delegated to the military. That's not so. The law says that is not so. In fact, the government not only is saying that police and the military do not need and have no legal obligation to protect you, but then they pass laws that make it difficult for you to protect you, right? Gun control and registration and confiscation and magazine capacity limits and all sorts of stuff. And that book has all sorts of other interesting examples. For example, in Utah, it's very easy to get a concealed weapons permit. In other places, it's not. In Utah, we are a shall issue state, meaning if you apply, they will give you a permit, provided that you haven't broken any laws. I'm from San Diego, and there you're at the complete mercy of your county sheriff. It's a may issue state. You apply, and they may issue you one, or in most cases, they may not. And depending on the disposition of your county sheriff, especially in California, it's most likely that you will not be given one. So I document in here some very compelling and interesting stories, one of which was a woman who repeatedly tried to get a permit and was denied the permit. And then she was attacked and had no recourse, legal recourse. She could have had a gun and been breaking the law, but she chose to obey the law, invalid though it was, didn't have a gun and was attacked. So the government not only is saying that it has no obligation to protect you, but it's making it difficult for you and I to do that for ourselves. Another facet I talk about in the book along these lines is democide. Have you heard of this term before? Democide. It means death by your own government. It's estimated in the 20th century alone that 262 million people were killed by their own government throughout the world. That's 3.7% of the entire human population at the time, killed by their own governments. Now, we know some of the bigger ones, Stalin and Hitler and Mao and these other ones, but when you read the list, tons of other countries did it, are doing it. There was an interesting quote from a Holocaust historian who said this, that the difference between resistance and submission depended very largely upon who was in possession of the arms that back up the will to do or die. The most foolish mistake we could possibly make would be to... this is Hitler. Sorry, I didn't make the distinction in my notes. Adolf Hitler said that the most foolish mistake we could possibly make would be to allow the subject races to possess arms. History shows that all conquerors who have allowed their subject races to carry arms have prepared their own downfall by so doing. Piers Morgan, if you know who he is, TV news host. A joke of a TV news host, if you ask me. But he's been doing show after show after show about gun control and using his show as propaganda to support more gun control, especially in the wake of the Newtown massacre and shooting. And it's interesting to watch that show because he advocates for the position that guns are for protection against the common criminal and hunting. And yes, true, that's not at all problematic, but guns traditionally were for, and today I think still are for, defending yourself against tyranny. And hope it never comes to that. But we can't beat around the bush and say that that hasn't been the case in the past and may not be the case in the future. The responsibility, the duty of self-defense is ours. So what are these actions? Going back to Abigail Adams, the actions, right? If you feel so inclined, by no means is it everyone should, but if you feel so inclined, get a weapon. Train with the weapon. Seek out training. Get practice. I love this quote from George Washington, that a free people ought not only to be armed, but disciplined. And by discipline, he meant trained. Be secure and alert. It's more likely that we're not going to fight against tyranny. Hopefully it never comes to that, but we face common criminals all the time. So self-defense is one of the responsibilities. In fact, there was an interesting quote I also didn't include in my notes, but I believe it was James Madison, and he was making the distinction in his time between Americans and those in Europe. And he said, look, in America, we love arms, and the government trusts its people with firearms. But in Europe, they're totally scared to let their citizens have guns. And what I comment in the book is that it's interesting that James Madison back in the day was saying that Americans loved firearms, and they had them, and they used them, and they understood them. But how much that has changed in the past two centuries. This responsibility of self-defense has completely declined. And I think along with it, the recognition that security does not come from empowering the government more and more and more to protect us. Because inevitably, the government that you empower to become a police state in the name of protecting you ends up turning on you, as has historically been the case. The next one I talk about in the book is financial freedom. This is a big one that I think is too often overlooked in terms of liberty. Let me pose it to you this way. Can you be a citizen activist? Can you fight for liberty? Actively, proactively, effectively fight for liberty if you're working a 9-to-5 job and have church commitments and family commitments. Maybe you're working two jobs. Maybe you're volunteering on the side for other things. It's extremely difficult to do so. Let me ask it this way. if the founding fathers had to work on a farm all day long, just for their own subsistence, who would have been the man in the halls of Congress to sign the Constitution, right? If not them, who else might have taken their place? Maybe men not as virtuous. It was their wealth, whether inherited or self-made, as was the case for many of them, that allowed them to be there, that allowed them to do the things that they did. An alarming statistic about consumer debt. Consumer debt means basically any debt minus your mortgage and education. $2.4 trillion in America. What's sad about that is that that's a staggering sum, but when we talk about how much debt America has, $2.4 trillion sadly doesn't seem like a lot, even though it's a huge amount, because we're so accustomed now to $16 trillion. That's just awful that we're accustomed to the word trillion. But it boils down to about $8,000 per person, $8,000 per person of consumer debt in America. 40% of families spend more than they earn. The contention that I want to make is that independence is secured by independence. By that I mean independence, freedom, liberty, is obtained by people who are independent. And that if Americans, we are so mired down in the bondage of debt that we're just focusing on ourselves, trying to get out of debt, trying to make do from paycheck to paycheck, that we're not able to reach outside of ourselves and fulfill other duties, which hopefully we would be able to fill, including our civic duty. We're not able to focus on things going around us and even focus, but more importantly, have an effect on the things going around us. Something that's closely tied to this is entrepreneurialism. These are some interesting statistics I didn't really realize before working on the book. 78% of businesses in America are self-employed entrepreneurs. Their total revenue is $1 trillion per year. Every day, an average of 2,400 people start a new business. These businesses account for 99% of all employers in the country and employ over half of everybody in the private sector. I didn't realize that at all. But you hear politicians say it, and hey, look, they're right that, you know, small businesses are the backbone of America. And there's so many benefits from entrepreneurialism as it relates to liberty, the responsibility of financial freedom, because the benefits of being an entrepreneur, and I talk about this in the book, I want to qualify it. By entrepreneur, I don't mean quitting your job and taking high risk and trying to start up a job. For years, I was working a 9-to-5 job until recently, and I had some entrepreneurial ventures on the side. Lunch breaks and nights and weekends and take a day off to work on it. Especially online businesses, if you're all technologically savvy, you can very easily work in. Entrepreneurialism is more, I think, an attitude than a schedule. So the actions, going back to Abigail Adams of financial freedom, again, I think these are far too overlooked as it relates to liberty, because so many of us are mired in debt, that we need to pay down debt. Debt is bondage. We cannot consider ourselves free if we are mired in debt. And how can we effectively and without hypocrisy demand freedom from the government and fight for freedom if we're not living it ourselves? Another thing I want to talk about is welfare and charity. This is a hot topic, an emotional topic for many. I want to go back to de Tocqueville real quick. Again, these observations from the founding era I think are fantastic because we've strayed so far from them. It's like I don't recognize this at all. But he writes of the America back in his day, "The citizen of the United States is taught from his earliest infancy to rely on his own exertions in order to resist the evils and difficulties of life. He looks upon social authority with an eye of mistrust and anxiety." Doesn't sound like America in our day at all. And let me substantiate that claim. In 2011, social welfare entitlement payouts made up 35% of Americans' wages and salaries, up from 21% just a decade earlier, and 10% in 1960. As I said, 48.5% of Americans now receive benefits from the government as of the 2000 census, so that's a very recent statistic. In that same year, 2010, 1,000 Americans were polled, and that poll found that 58% of people believed that a good work ethic would not pay off, and only 26% believed it was still possible for just about anyone in America to work hard and generate wealth. how much of a contrast between de Tocqueville's America back in his day, the work ethic, people believing that they could make do for themselves. There was an interesting exchange on a subcommittee in Congress 2 years ago, June 2011. And one of the directors of the Government Accountability Office, the GAO, was asked by this congressman who was heading up the subcommittee, how many federal welfare programs exist? Simple question. Not how much money they spent, not how many programs they run, nothing really complex data-wise. This individual from the GAO was tasked, it's her job, to oversee all this stuff. That's the reason that the Government Accountability Office exists at all, right? It was a testy exchange. She couldn't provide an answer. Congressman came from multiple angles, trying to ask in different ways, trying to pin her down. She couldn't answer. She said she did not know and was unable to answer. The very individual in government who is employed full-time to be in charge of simply understanding the scope, the magnitude of what government's doing, let alone all of the nitty-gritty, and she couldn't even provide a number. Now, estimates suggest there are around 80. 80 federal welfare programs in America. This doesn't count the many, 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 many state programs. Since 1964, when the war on poverty was declared, $16 trillion has been spent, and yet the number of people dependent on the government continues to increase. I found this to be interesting when I was doing research for the book. This was from FDR in 1935 in his State of the Union address. Now, of course, FDR was a huge proponent of these programs, instituted many of them in their inception. But listen to what he says. The lessons of history, confirmed by the evidence immediately before me, show conclusively that continued dependence upon relief induces a spiritual disintegration fundamentally destructive to the national fiber. To dole out relief in this way is to administer a narcotic, a subtle destroyer of the human spirit. Wow. I had to double check that one and check my source to make sure it wasn't one of those fictional internet quotes that I had come across. Of which there are many. But this is legit. State of the Union, 1935. Now, of course, to his credit, as is common today, when these programs are first instituted, they're very narrow in scope, right? So these programs, when they're first instituted, the Social Security, oh, we won't take more than 1% of your taxes ever, right? When these programs are instituted, it's specifically for the very, very, very needy. And how hard is it to object? You know, you object to that on principle, and people say that you hate people who are needy and you want them to die on the sidewalk. And so people go along with that because, oh, at least it's only this. But, of course, it's the camel's nose in the tent that then expands over the decades to be these albatross programs we have now. So much of what the state does today is under the pretense of taking care of people. I'll suggest to you this as one example of that. So I was up at the legislature, you may know, just concluded last week, the Utah State Legislature. They meet for 45 days at the beginning of every year. And I can't tell you how many bills there were under discussion where the argument used to justify this bill, usually a socialism-related bill, was that, well, because the government has to foot the bill for these people, should they be in need, therefore we should support X and Y and Z. For example, let me get more specific. There's a federal law that requires hospitals to admit under their care any individual who walks into their emergency room. They cannot turn anyone away. Now, hospitals are a business, right? They shouldn't be compelled to provide care for those who can't pay for it. As tragic as that is, it is not the government's authority to dictate to a private business that they must provide care. And yet there is a federal law that compels them to do so. And because of that fact, and because taxpayers are on the hook for providing that care, all sorts of other things then come in the front door. That's how Obamacare was justified, right? Well, we don't want to have to pay for all this expensive emergency room care. Therefore, we need to coerce Americans into obtaining health insurance so that we can keep them healthy on the front end so we don't have to pay for them on the back end. There were many bills in the Utah legislature that argued the same exact thing because of the hospital care issue. Providing medical care for people with autism, with hearing problems, with other things as well. Well, because taxpayers are going to have to take care of them, if we don't take care of them more cheaply earlier, therefore we should pass all these laws. So the state is taking care of people, claims to be taking care of people. But all along the way, liberty is violated. So what are the actions? Again, going back to Abigail Adams, for welfare and charity. I think it's very easy, probably there wouldn't be any disagreement in this room, that it is a failure of our responsibility to take care of ourselves and one another that has led to the government aiming to do so on our behalf. So the actions are, we need to take care of ourselves. We need to take care of others. We need to support other organizations, private organizations, that are attempting to do the same. There was a fascinating bill up for discussion in the legislature a couple weeks ago, and a representative stood up. His name's Mike Kennedy from Highland, and he's a doctor, primary care physician. And this bill was dealing with medical care, was dealing with compulsory medical care, and he was voting against it, and he wanted to explain why. And in his remarks, when he explained why, he said, you know, I have a calling in my ward. He's LDS. And I dedicate so many hours a week, and I'm happy to do it. I'm happy to help. And he said, imagine if the church, my church, his church, he was saying, called me to render 5 hours a week of medical care for free. And that was my calling. And now imagine if 3,000 other doctors did the same. What would that do? Now, of course, there's liability concerns and logistics and all sorts of other stuff. But imagine, whether through a church, whether through a private organization, if those with the know-how to do so, doctors, nurses, technicians, rendered that care, offered that care on a private, voluntary basis. We would be taking care of people so much easier. In fact, before a government really stuck its foot in the door, there were church hospitals that would take care of people for free. And of course, that was back before so much government intervention, which is skyrocketed costs, and it's made it all very difficult. But that is where we need to return, and we need to support organizations and initiatives that will take us in that direction. A few other ones, because I'm running low on time. Preparedness, self-reliance. This is a big one. I'm LDS. In my last stake, we just recently moved, I was the stake preparedness specialist. And a couple years ago, we did a stake-wide analysis of how much food storage everyone has. And it was fascinating to do that because I've long heard all these statistics of how many members of the church have food storage because they've been counseled for so long to have it. So we had an opportunity in our whole community. This was in Traverse Mountain, if you know where that is, down in Lehigh by Point of the Mountain. We went door to door, not just members of our faith. We knocked on every single door. And through our whole community, we found that we had about 1.5 months of food storage. If everyone was to just share equally, because some people had a year, 2 years, of course they're self-reporting, we weren't looking at everything. They're probably inflating the numbers a little bit. But some people would have a year or two of food storage, and then other people would have literally a week. It was tragic. Whether in some cases that was because they didn't have money, in other cases they just lived week to week from the grocery store and they just bought what they needed. And so it ended up being about a month and a half. We asked about 72-hour kits, and about 25% of people had 72-hour kits. In our neighborhood, as part of the larger community, we also asked about water storage, because how many people think of water? Maybe you haven't thought about water storage. So few people in my experience think about water storage in context of food storage. In fact, I remember, when I was going door-to-door, I asked, and knocked on the door, I was talking to a neighbor, asked him how much food storage, and he boasted. 2 years. He was so happy to be able to share with someone that he was extra obedient. And I asked him how much water storage he had. None. And he would have, unless he had some, his water heater, a couple other things, and boiling snow if there was any, he could have died in a week, right? People don't think about water storage. So the important thing I'll leave here before moving on to another topic really quick to work towards the end about preparedness and self-reliance is the principle of acting versus being acted upon. And now think about that in the context of liberty. If you're being acted upon in an emergency, you have no money, you have no food, you're completely dependent and at the mercy of other people who are helping you, hopefully, you're not able to help other people. You're not able to focus on immediate things such as liberty and logistics and organization. As I said, I'm from San Diego, specifically Poway. And several years ago, there were some fires down in that area. You may see a couple nods that ravaged the area. Many, many homes built, burnt down. And my mother was on the city council for total like a decade. And all the other city councilmen were like asleep at the wheel, just attending to their own needs. And my mom shows up to the emergency evacuation center, whatever it was called, and just runs everything. And all these refugees, if you want to call them that, but people whose homes had burned down start coming over. And it was really interesting as she related the story to me. I wasn't living there at the time. One family escaped from their home with the big screen TV. There was, and not to stereotype, but just that's the way it was, there was an Asian family, stereotypically at least known for being very strict on academics and very good academic performance. And the father grabbed the backpacks, his children's school backpacks, and that was all he grabbed. And in the heat of the moment, you don't think well. You're not, if you're not prepared, you're not in a condition to be able to respond. And so they just grabbed what they could think of, and everything burned down. So if and when emergencies come, you know, we're due for a massive fault along the Wasatch, a massive quake along the Wasatch Fault. Many other emergencies can happen, have happened. If you are not prepared, are you going to be in a condition to try and improve other circumstances? Are you going to be able to act, or are you going to be acted upon? This perhaps is one of the more easy to achieve aspects of responsibility that is highly neglected. And it's very, you know, it's very easy. Just start shopping, acquire a short-term food supply, get a 72-hour kit. Start learning skills that could be useful. You know, I'm a computer guy, and I think all the time, you know, when when Armageddon happens or whatever you want to call it in the last days scenario, we're not going to need websites. You know, I build websites for a living. I need to acquire skills that are going to be useful. I'm learning how to, you know, we're getting beehives and huge garden in our new home and all sorts of stuff, trying to learn to be more self-sufficient. Because this relates to liberty in a very compelling and direct way should something happen. I want to rattle through the last list of the responsibilities I talk about just very briefly, and then I'll conclude. Another one I talk about is education. This quote from George Washington demonstrates why I think it's compelling. He says, "The best means of forming a manly, virtuous, and happy people will be found in the right education of youth. Without this foundation, every other means, in my opinion, must fail." Every other means. How are our children doing? How are the public schools? How are our home schools? How are our private schools? By no means is our government schools the only problem when we talk about education. How are our children doing? Do they understand the principles that we're talking about tonight, that we hold dear? Are they being exposed to these things? So that's a big one, big responsibility that we need to pay attention to. Civic duty. I want to read this quote from Thomas Jefferson where he explains why it's important. "Cherish the spirit of our people and keep alive their attention. Do not be too severe upon their errors, but reclaim them by enlightening them. If once they become inattentive to the public affairs, you and I and Congress and assemblies, judges and governors shall all become wolves." I think we have plenty of wolves today. So we need to get people's attention going. We need to get our attention going. I like this, do not be too severe upon their errors. Again, we don't want to tear down. We don't want to be too Tom Paine-ish. We want to come prepared with a John Adams type of solution of what should be built up in the place of tearing down. Another responsibility I think is important is food production. I share some interesting stories in here which I think are very interesting about the connection between food production and freedom. And specifically in the reverse, what the government has done to food and how food definitely affects your composition, your ability to work, your ability to have energy, your ability to be able to influence the lives of others around you. Ezra Taft Benson says this, "There are blessings in being close to the soil, in raising your own food, even if it is only a garden in your yard and a fruit tree or two. Those families will be fortunate who in the last days have an adequate supply of food because of their foresight and ability to produce their own." Closely tonight tied to the preparedness aspect, but I think it has enough material to stand alone on its own as a responsibility. Family. Michael Novak, maybe you've heard of him, he's an American journalist. He says this, that between the omnipotent state and the naked individual looms the first line of resistance against totalitarianism, the economically and politically independent family. Protecting the space within which free and independent individuals may receive the necessary years of nurture. How are our families doing? Are they that line of defense between the individual and the state? Do we treat them as such? Do we recognize them as such? Do we structure family time and instruction and meetings and discipline in that context? Are we trying to raise our children to organize families the same way, to be freedom-loving and strong, to resist the encroachments of the state? And then finally, the last responsibility I'll touch on, and perhaps the most important, is faith and morality. Another de Tocqueville quote, because he's so easy and so good to quote. He says, "I'm inclined to think that if faith be wanting in the citizen, he must be subject, and if he be free, he must believe." Again, he recognized the virtue that permeated American society. How are we doing today? Easy rhetorical answer to answer, I think, in the unfortunate negative. But again, the remedy to this collective disbelief and lack of importance placed in faith and morality is the individual. We don't need big solutions. We need a lot of little solutions. We need a lot of correction in our own individual lives. And then a story in conclusion. There's an engineer in Holland by the name of Hans Mondermann. Traffic engineer. He designs roads and intersections. He's not a fan of road signs, which is kind of interesting. Here's a guy who has to build for thousands of cars coming and going, and he doesn't like road signs. This is a quote from him. "The trouble with traffic engineers is that when there's a problem with a road, they always try to add something. To my mind, it's much better to remove things." So he removes them. He designed this busy intersection in Holland, removed every single sign, which you'd think would be just a traffic nightmare. And yet the opposite was true. His intersection that was shared in this story is a junction between two busy two-lane roads that handle 20,000 cars a day, as well as thousands of bicyclists and pedestrians. Where traffic lights, road markings, and pedestrian crossings once existed, Mondermann put a roundabout void of any signs or signals telling drivers who has the right of way, how fast they may go, when to turn, and so on. So imagine being a tourist in this country. You drive to this intersection for the first time, and you chuckle because you think it might just be horrendous. And yet think more about how you might approach driving your own vehicle this intersection with no signs. You'd probably reduce your speed. You would notice this complete absence of signs. What would you do? You'd probably hesitate. And your initial hesitation, the pause to consider your actions, is precisely the point of his design. A journalist who witnessed the results of this design recorded his impressions as follows. "Mondermann and I stand in silence by the side of the road a few minutes, watching the stream of motorists, cyclists, and pedestrians make their way through the circle, a giant concrete mixing bowl of transport. Somehow it all works. The drivers, slow to gauge the intentions of crossing bicyclists and walkers. Negotiations over right-of-way are made through fleeting eye contact. Remarkably, traffic moves smoothly around the circle with hardly a brake screeching, horn honking, or obscene gesture." "I love it," Mondermann said. And then he continues, "Pedestrians and cyclists used to avoid this place. But now, as you see, the cars look out for the cyclists look out for the pedestrians, and everyone looks out for each other. You can't expect traffic signs and street markings to encourage that sort of behavior. You have to build it into the design of the road." Just as traffic signs and street markings do not necessarily encourage or produce proper driving behavior, laws do not encourage responsibility. If anything, they make us less responsible because we assume that everyone else is following the rules and that the government has everything under control. These laws create a false sense of security in which we look to the rules and regulations and not to one another to determine how to act and what to do. But this striking example, one which the journalist notes is spreading around the globe, epitomizes the symbiotic relationship between liberty and responsibility. As liberty is restored, people assume their responsibilities. As people become more responsible, they can claim, maintain, and defend more of their liberty. Lord Acton once defined liberty as the highest political end. It was his contention that that is the object and design of all proper law, liberty. It is the purpose for which governments exist. It's what they should all be about. So if liberty is the highest political end, what I want to leave with you tonight, what I want to emphasize, is that responsibility is the highest personal end. We can fight for liberty through the political system, whether through parties or organizations or whatever your efforts want to be, wherever your talents and interests lie. That can be and should be our highest political end. But we're not at all going to be successful, and I think the reason why we haven't been successful up until this point is that responsibility has not been our highest personal end. And maybe you're there already yourself, maybe not. I'm not. But I think we need to make responsibility our highest personal end, and then and only when we'll be able to defend, restore liberty. Thank you.